It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a Milwaukee-area resident built a Christmas lights display in his front yard, and he wants you to play with the display over the internet. We'll talk to him about why he did it and how it works coming up. First, for many people, finding a career you like can be a source of stress. It can take a lot of work to find job openings and apply for them. Even when you get that job, it's not always what you expected. Our next guest says knowing more about your own mind and the minds of others can change the way you work, and if you wanted to, change where you work. Art Markman is a professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also a cognitive scientist and co-host of the radio show and podcast, Two Guys on Your Head, that's at KUT Radio in Austin. His latest book is called Bring Your Brain to Work, Using Cognitive Science to Get a Job, Do It Well, and Advance Your Career. Art, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
A running theme through your book is that wherever we are in our work lives, a lot of us just, I don't know, kind of move from one thing to another and don't take a lot of time to think about it or examine it. How do we break out of that?
Well, I think there's a lot of things to do. You know, and one of the first is to get to know yourself a little bit better. And two of the big things that people can do to really begin that process are first to understand a little bit more about their own values. We don't actually talk a lot about values. We don't teach people a lot about them. And yet, what you really want in your life turns out to be a critical determinant of how happy you are in the work that you're doing. So, for example, some people really value achievement. They want to be known for their success, while other people value things like benevolence, that they want to actually have a job and have a life in which they do things for other people. Some people value tradition, where they want to really cling to their culture, whereas others value pleasure and really the enjoyment of their lives. And so you really need to get to know, first of all, who you are. And the second thing that's really valuable to do is to actually get a decent assessment of your own personality characteristics, not the Myers-Briggs that makes its way through so many workplaces, but to do something like actually get a big five personality workup and get to know these characteristics like extroversion and openness and conscientiousness. And the reason for that is that your personality reflects what you are motivated to do, all else being equal. And the more you understand about that, the more that you can tailor the work that you do to the way that you're motivated to do things.
Yeah, you're coming from this cognitive science background. What made you think, hey, I want to use this stuff I've been working on for so long and figure out how we can use these tools at every stage of our career?
So I've been particularly interested in trying to figure out not just how to study cognitive science, and I've certainly written plenty of papers that get read by 30 of my closest colleagues, but also to really figure out how other people could benefit from what it is that the field has learned. Unfortunately, the psychology didn't make the cut when we were laying out our modern science curriculum. And so most people learn very little about the way their minds work, despite the fact that they're going to be asked to think for a living. And so I've spent a lot of time really, you know, trying to write about and talk about the ways that the latest research can help people to do what they do. And I've tried to do it in a lot of different settings. And the more that I thought about the struggles that people go through in the workplace, the more that I felt like a better understanding of cognitive science would really benefit people.
And one thing I love is you talk about not separating ourselves, our identities from our workplace and bringing in things from other realms. And you live by this through the book. You've got these sidebars. You play saxophone, as I do. You keep drawing lessons from your efforts to learn how to play jazz saxophone. How did you figure out how to put those two together?
You know, it's funny, and it's always fun to talk to a fellow sax player. You know, I took up the saxophone in my mid-30s. I had read all this research on regret, and one of the things that the research on regret tells us is that what people who are in their 70s, 80s, and 90s tend to regret are the things in their lives they didn't do, not the things in their lives that they did that were stupid. And so I then took that research and asked myself, what would I regret not having done, and came up with the saxophone. And at the time, I really thought, you know, I'm just doing this for myself. I'm doing this isn't going to feed back on anything else that I'm doing, but it'll just give me a sense of joy and accomplishment. But over time, the more that I played, the more that I realized that there were some really valuable lessons for work and leadership in playing the saxophone. And, you know, my favorite is the advice that they give to people when you first start playing with other musicians. They tell you that that what you can think of as the first law of jazz is that whenever you sit in with a new group, you have to listen more than you play. Because, of course, there's this tendency to want to rush out and prove to everybody that you deserve to be playing with this group. But if you do that, no matter how capable the licks you end up playing, you don't blend in with everybody else. And it's only by listening and figuring out how to fill in the gaps that people are leaving that you actually blend in with what's going on. And that turns out to be extraordinarily powerful as a tool in the workplace, that no matter how much you want to prove that you belong in the job that you've been given, if you listen a lot, you can find your spots to really make a contribution.
Talking to Art Markman, his new book is called Bring Your Brain to Work, Using Cognitive Science to Get a Job, Do It Well, and Advance Your Career. Art, we often hear, it's kind of a graduation speech cliche, the idea, hey, when you're looking for work, find your passion. Is that something that we should do, or is passion what we think it is in the first place?
You know, it is certainly important to be passionate about the work that you're doing. After all, you're going to spend about 70,000 hours at work over the course of your career. So you'd better enjoy it. You'd better feel like it amounts to something. But the problem with saying find your passion is that it makes the assumption that there's a thing out there that you are going to love to do, and that if you don't find that thing, then you're going to end up having an unfulfilling career. When in fact, the research suggests you can learn to love all kinds of jobs, and that what's really important is not the particular tasks that you're doing day to day, but rather the degree to which you feel like the work that you're doing adds up to something that's really bigger than yourself, that is contributing to something important, and that fits those values that you have. Because even if you feel like you are working on something that other people would find valuable and important, if it's not something that really reflects your own values, you're going to have a hard time getting up in the morning.
Another thing I love in your book is you say sometimes people make a radical career change when something big and maybe bad happens, a loss, a near-death experience, whatever. You say don't wait for that. Maybe check in every year to see if you need that big change before something big happens to you.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's funny. One of the things that I did as I was writing the book was to do interviews with a lot of people, and actually to also pull folks from my social media and just ask them questions. And as I was writing a chapter about whether you should move away from your career and actually do something different, or to move on to another firm or to move up in your own organization, one of the things that I found that was common for a lot of people who decided to switch careers was that they had undergone some kind of personal crisis, a death in the family, a near-death experience, a serious illness. And I realized that that's the sort of thing that gives people the energy and the willingness, by confronting death in some way, to really make a significant change so that they don't stay in a career that really isn't fulfilling for them. And I feel like that's, you don't have to wait for some tragedy to strike before you should be willing to take that hard look at things. And in fact, you don't want to do it every day. But about once a year, and you can pick that time, whether it's the yearly HR evaluation that you have at work, or whether it's your birthday, or whether it's New Year's. We're coming up on New Year's now, which is a time when people evaluate a lot of aspects of your life. It's really important to ask yourself, do I feel good about the trajectory I'm on? And if not, to begin to add things into your life that are going to make changes so that next year you are closer to being on that trajectory than you are now.
We're talking to Art Markman, cognitive scientist and professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about his new book. It's called Bring Your Brain to Work, Using Cognitive Science to Get a Job, Do It Well, and Advance Your Career. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you hit a point in your life where you evaluated what you were doing and decided, yeah, this is great, I'm going to stick with it, or, hey, it's time for a change? If it was time for a change, how did you pursue that? Maybe different career, different job. Do you have questions for our guest about how to know our minds and use that information to get a job, keep a job, move up in a job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we pick up our talk with Art Markman. He's a professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about his new book. It's called Bring Your Brain to Work, Using Cognitive Science to Get a Job, Do It Well, and Advance Your Career. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something you wish your younger self had known when deciding on a career? Have you hit a point in your life where you wanted to switch? Or do you have a smaller, more practical thing that you would like to share or ask about? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Brent is with us in Oconto. Brent, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about?
Yeah, I got a couple things. First of all, I just want to tell, I was a lawyer for about 15 years, and I got burned out pretty hard, and I decided to go off and do some teaching. I did that at the high school level, taught freshman history, and I enjoyed the teaching, but I did not enjoy the bureaucratic environment of being a teacher, and I also didn't, I missed the independence that came from being an attorney. So I went back to being an attorney, and now it seems like for a while I'm cured of the burnout. So it was good that I took that sabbatical. It didn't wind up being a new career, but it was good to take that break. The other thing I want to talk about, I remember as a young person, guidance counselors in school, you know, here we are, we're in high school, 16, 17 years old, and being told we have to pick what we do with our lives. And there is no 16 or 17-year-old that knows who they are. You know, we don't even know what we don't know. So that pressure to pick what you're going to be for, if not the rest of your life, most of your life, it seems unfair to put that on a teenager.
Brent, thank you so much for the call. All right, let's start with that second point. I know that is an issue you have as well, that know your major before you go to college, for example.
Oh, yeah, that Brent, I hear you. And by the way, congratulations on getting away from the career for a while and giving yourself a little bit of a sabbatical. That was a great idea. Yeah, you know, I find it fascinating that we ask people to choose a career early on. We ask people to choose their major early on in career in their lives. And there's two problems with that. One, of course, is you don't really know who your adult self is going to be. And Brent, you were pointing that out. The other is that all you know is what you've experienced so far. And your ability to envision the future is so deeply dependent on what you've encountered before in your life. I know that when I was in high school, I took a career test to suggest career opportunities for me, and it told me I should be an accountant, not because I really should be an accountant, but because my dad's an accountant. It was something I grew up around and something that was familiar. I think we need to give people a little bit more time to explore things, and I also think we need to give people an opportunity to get an education that's going to be a broad-based education that's going to help them to determine their future rather than an education that is narrowly pointed towards a particular career. I think these days we've devalued the liberal arts despite the importance that those disciplines have for teaching us about humanity. Most of us find that that the biggest problems we solve in the workplace are human-centered problems, and yet we spend most of our time pushing people towards technical fields, and it's not that those technical fields are a problem. It's just that if we do that to the exclusion of understanding people, we are making it hard for people to adapt to the workplace as they get into it.
Brent, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. And Art, you say, you know, maybe we don't do enough to learn those people skills in the workplace. We might come out of whatever our education is, maybe, as you say, with those technical skills, but not with the stuff we need to do in a job interview or a meeting or a career.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think that it's fascinating to me. I mean, partly we don't learn a lot of psychology, which might help us to interact with people better, to negotiate with people better. But we also, as I point out, we don't spend a lot of time thinking about the liberal arts. I spent the previous 8 years, I took a new position at the university last year, but before that I was the director of a fairly new program here at the University of Texas called the Human Dimensions of Organizations, where both at the undergraduate and at the master's level, we try to use the liberal arts to teach people about people because we've recognized that so much of what people have to do each day in the workplace is to navigate difficulties with individuals, how group dynamics function, as well as trying to understand organizational culture and how that affects the work that you do. And I think we need to put more of that back into our education.
Talking to Art Markman, author of Bring Your Brain to Work, Using Cognitive Science to Get a Job, Do It Well, and Advance Your Career. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a story of career burnout, a career change, or realizing you were pretty happy where you were, I want to hear your thought process at 800-642-1234. Art, we've spent a lot of time on bigger picture stuff, but a lot of your book is advice for particular situations along the job path and the career path. Let's get into some of that. How about applying some of the cognitive sciences that you work with to the job interview? What can that teach us? What can we take away from it?
Yeah, you know, the one of the things about job interviews, we have to recognize that we carry a lot of habits with us from experiences that we've had throughout our lives. And one of the things about job interviews is that they resemble exams. And so we carry this frame with us that the interview is like an exam. And that has a couple of problems with it. One of which is it means that we tend to treat that interview as we have to impress the interviewer, but not to take enough time to learn about the organization from what it is that happens in that interview process. So, for example, suppose that you don't know the answer to a question. Well, on an exam, that's of course a bad thing. But in the case of a job interview, if they ask you a question that stumps you, start a conversation. Even admit, I'm not exactly sure how to answer this, and see what happens. If the organization is one that really wants to teach you in the workplace, that wants to help you to grow as an employee, then they're going to treat that opportunity as a chance to show how they lead you to be able to do new things. And if they just look at you and say, well, you didn't know the answer, so we're just going to give you a big red X, they're also teaching you something about the degree to which they are going to develop you over the course of your career. So you really have to treat this as a two-way street, as a partnership, and to remember that you are learning as much about the organization that you're interviewing with as they are from about you in the course of that interview.
Let's bring on another caller now. David is with us in Milwaukee. David, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, David?
Hey, so here your topic. I had a pretty drastic career change. I went from being a early childhood elementary school teacher with a four-year degree to now I work as an electrician, union electrician, and I basically work in construction now with a bunch of folks that have been brought up more through trade school and that, you know, route. And it is amazing the communication that I don't see on a daily basis that I kind of try to weave myself through. And it's because, you know, some of these people just have never been in an environment where there was communication that was taught and, you know, cultures that I see between the different kinds of workers on a job site and everything.
I got to ask, though, David, are you happy with that career change? That is a pretty substantial shift.
Oh, absolutely. I kind of always grew up a little bit more blue collar, and then I was kind of really pressured into going into college. So I did that, and that was good. I really do value my liberal arts education, but I absolutely love where I'm at in life now.
David,
as an electrician.
Thanks so much for that call. But there it is, Art. David, it sounds like he's taking some of his liberal arts education and wondering if it could help even in a very technical job like construction electrician.
That's, you know, it's fascinating. I mean, one of the things that I find really interesting is that so many people feel like the work that they do doesn't lead to something tangible that they can hold on to. You know, one of the dangers of being in the knowledge economy that we're in is that you can spend a lot of time pushing papers around and engaging in conversations and meetings without necessarily getting a real feel for this is something I've accomplished. And when you build something, one of the things that does is, you know, you walk away from it and there it is. I think that's, you know, we have to find ways to create that kind of satisfaction in a variety of jobs, whether it's actual construction where you have something that you built or whether you're doing something that's a little bit more abstract than that. And even education where you have all these kids that you're working with, it can still be, I think, a little difficult to see what contribution that you've made. So that fascinates me. I think another piece to this that's really important is that these skills, these human-centered skills, are critical in every workplace, and it's not just in a workplace that is where we think of the modern office as being computer screens and people work, you know, sending emails to each other, but even in construction sites, and I've spoken to a lot of construction companies over the years, there's a lot of teamwork. You know, a mistake in a construction project can be physically dangerous to the workers. It can put projects behind schedule. It is absolutely crucial to develop those communication skills in everyone, even if the education that people got before getting onto the work site didn't necessarily value that. And I'd love to see more companies really engaging in teaching those kinds of skills as part of their workforce training.
David, thanks for the call. Time for one more caller. Sam is with us in Milwaukee. Sam, hi.
Hi, just wanted to chime in. I appreciate the information that you're sharing. I'm 40 years old. The epiphany I've had recently, I'm in the process of considering my next career move, is what fits me naturally? You know, what qualities do I have? What skills do I have in which I could apply that to a job and find a job that naturally fits who I am as a person?
Sam, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left, but Art, for somebody in Sam's position, how do they do that? How do they evaluate those natural fits?
You know, I think one of the things that's really important to do is to get out there and talk with a bunch of people about specifically about the work that they're doing day to day, and just get a feel for do I feel like the things that I enjoy doing are a part of that job. You know, hanging out with friends, hanging out, you know, getting out there, even in volunteer situations where you encounter a lot of people, just, you know, talk to people about what they're doing, because one of the things that you find is you begin to hear these resonances there of, oh, that sounds like a really cool job. And that can actually push you away from just what you know and towards things that other people are doing.
Thanks a lot for that call, Sam. And Art, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Great talking with you today.
That's Art Markman, professor of psychology and marketing at the University of Texas at Austin. He's a cognitive scientist and co-host of the radio show and podcast called Two Guys on Your Head on KUT Radio in Austin. His new book is Bring Your Brain to Work, Using Cognitive Science to Get a Job, Do It Well, and Advance Your Career. Coming up after the news, a Wisconsin man set up a website to let people control his household Christmas lights. We'll find out why he did it and how you can take your turn. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Congress voted last week to raise the minimum smoking age to 21. We'll talk about who supported that change and what health experts are saying about its potential impact. Now, it's always fun to drive around and look at people's Christmas lights. What if you had the power to control what they do? Thanks to the internet and our next guest from Wauwatosa, you can. People from all over the world are going online and taking part. Mike Walczak is a Wauwatosa native and creator of MKELights.com. That's where all the lighting magic happens. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here. Thanks for reaching out.
Before you did this online manifestation of your lights, were you big into the decorating lights anyway?
So I've always been really big into lights, not only with Christmas. My background, well, it's hard to say background, but when I was younger in my teenage years and high school, college years, I was a DJ for a local company, and part of that involved setting up different type of lighting displays for clients. So that really opened the door to my interest about lighting. And then as I left that and moved on to my full-time job, which doesn't involve that, I started to look for other ways that I could still enjoy the season as well as enjoy my love of different types of lighting techniques. And that's where I started to venture out. So I also do Halloween, not like this, but I look for different ways to incorporate lightning and whenever I can in my house.
And are you known kind of in the neighborhood as the guy who decorates everything?
I think I have definitely gotten that reputation. The neighbors that I know, you know, all think that I'm crazy, but not necessarily in a bad way.
Right.
They enjoy it too. And I through the years, there's definitely people that I recognize driving past the house or during other holidays, Halloween, for instance, coming back for trick or treat and commenting on it and how much they enjoy seeing it every year. So I think I've definitely set a name for myself over here in the Wauwatosa neighborhood that I live in.
Now, here you are online. What made you want to do that?
So most of the displays that I've done up until this point have really been more local based. And so on top of my love of lighting, I also had this passion growing up for both graphic design and developing in terms of internet protocol stuff. So I did it more as like a freelance thing, things for fun. I would just learn how to code on the side when I was younger. And as I got older and I had more resources and financial ability to do so, I tried to figure out ways that I could mesh my two loves together. There was a previous individual who had done something similar to what I'm currently doing, who has since retired from doing it. And I was always very inspired by it. So I just, again, took my love of coding along with my love of Christmas and decided I would give it a try for myself.
There are a lot of webcams out there where you can look at, you know, polar bears frolicking or decorations or city landscapes. You took it a step
right.
further, though. We're not just looking at your lighting display. We can control it. What does that look like for somebody going online?
Oh, it's definitely a very unique thing going forward. Like you said, there's a lot of other different types of cams that you can access as the internet, but there's not a whole lot that you can be interactive with. So for me, I wanted to take it to that next level. And actually up until this year, we only had one cam available. But there's so much that I love to put out on my lawn. There's so much that I'd love to expand with this down the future is I needed to open up more space. So by changing the angles of what I could allow a user to see, adding that second camera this year has hopefully allowed me to expand this venture even bigger going forward.
Talking to Mike Walczak from Wauwatosa about his annual holiday lighting display. He's got a lot of Christmas lights up, and you can see them online, and you can turn them on and off online. So what are some of your favorite lighting setups there that we can actually play with online, Mike?
So I have some of the classics that I've had since I started this back in 2017. So like the Deer Duo, which as I call them online, is this really insanely bright two deer that stand by each other. And then I have the original big Frosty the Snowman. And then I have the icicle lights, which are always a favorite of mine. This year, I've actually expanded to add a few new elements, including a little Frosty. I call it a little penguin. We've got Santa there now. We've got his friend Rudolph, of course, in a small Christmas tree. So in total, we're up to about 16 different elements that you can control independently on or off through my website, mkelights.com. But the originals that I mentioned before are always probably going to be my favorites.
So there's 16 elements we can control. There are more than 16 elements in your yard, I'm guessing, right?
Correct. There's obviously each element has a lot of lights encased to it. So just because you're turning Frosty in doesn't mean you're just turning one light on. That Frosty probably has about 400 lights in it. But for some things on the website, they're just singular elements, meaning that's the one item that you're turning on or off. Otherwise, there's a couple other ones like bushes or other trees. Those, if you turn on or off, you're actually going to turn multiple things on or off at once.
How many people at a time might be online trying to turn lights on and off?
So this is actually very much a different answer this year than I would have told you in years past. So just to kind of put this into perspective for you, when I first started in 2017, I would go to work and I'd come home and I would see maybe a light had turned on or off while I had been gone. And last year, occasionally I would catch it while I was out front or looking out the window. This year, it's pretty frequently. There's somebody on the website. I think our max this year was just over 200 concurrently, which is not ideal. although the server can handle it, it's, you know, when you have a finite amount of lights to turn on, there's only so much you can do with 200 people on at once.
Yeah, if I'm online and somebody in Sweden is online and somebody in Nigeria is online and we all want to do the same thing, like do you get light fights?
For sure. And the people that I know that you know, from work or other friends, they will often tell me that they'll compete with people elsewhere, even people that they know who can turn the lights on, who can turn them off. Some people want to turn all the lights off, some people want to turn it on, and even myself, from time to time, if I'll play with it, I'll turn something on and I'll see somebody immediately turn it back off. So there's definitely light fights. And although that 200 number is kind of what we peak at, I would say generally if you're on there, there are times where you will be able to get there with this maybe 10 other users. And that's probably when your experience will be best. But if you're finding that you're getting on there and you're really having difficulty seeing that you're able to turn a light on, a light on or off, then I'd recommend probably just trying back in like 15 minutes.
Do you ever just sit out in the yard and watch the lights go on and off unpredictably?
You know, I don't. You know, whenever I drive home from somewhere, I'll always kind of pause for a second before I pull up in the driveway just to see, you know, what's going on. Since it's now basically always an expectation that something's going on at some point, I know that if I look out the window, I'm going to see something. Last year, I was always a bit more, is there somebody on there right now? Is there somebody on there right now? Whereas, like I said, now I can pretty much always assume somebody is. I have a 3-year-old daughter who's also really excited about the Christmas lights this year. And while she doesn't completely understand what is actually happening out front, she herself loves looking at the lights and that having them turn on or off. But again, she doesn't really realize why they're turning on or off. But
you're doing this year after year, and maybe this is too soon to ask you, but do you have any thoughts or innovations in mind for Christmas season 2020?
So I would definitely like to figure out other ways that I could allow. So 16 devices is great. I also don't want to get too crazy. But figuring out other ways that we could expand the amount of users that can successfully use this system at once. There's also some ideas that I've been tossing around about having some sort of mix between what I currently have as well as a light show. So perhaps at the start of every hour, the controls turn off and the house with the lights out front does some sort of musical performance. And then after those 3 minutes or so of the performance, then it goes right back to you can turn them on or off. That way it's the same controls that we all have and that we love to play with right now, but it also mixes in that other aspect of light design and holiday themed music, which could, you know, make it something interesting and a reason for a user to check back every hour.
Mike, I have 4 words for you. I know you don't necessarily need unsolicited advice. The 4 words are internet controlled holiday drones. What do you think?
You know what? I'm always open to suggestions and any, you know, it sounds exciting. Let's talk.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Yes, thank you. Merry Christmas.
Mike Walczak is a Wauwatosa native and creator of MKELights.com. There you can not only see Mike's Christmas lights display in front of his house, but actually turn a bunch of them on and off between 5 and 10 p.m. He'll have the controls up through the rest of the year. Again, that's MKELights.com. Coming up, we'll find out why both health groups and tobacco companies supported the vote by Congress last week to raise the smoking age to 21. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, many of Wisconsin's hospitals are run by Catholic institutions. A new report says that can have an impact on the kinds of care people have access to. First, the minimum age to buy tobacco products in the U.S. will be going up from 18 to 21. The change was part of a broad government spending package President Trump signed on Friday night. The new age limit, which also applies to e-cigarettes, had bipartisan support in Congress, and it was backed by health organizations and some tobacco industry groups. Certain supporters, however, say more needs to be done to lower nicotine addiction among teenagers. Dr. Patrick Remington is professor emeritus at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here. Thanks.
Where did this push for raising the smoking age to 21 initially come from?
Well, it's been proposed for over 100 years. In fact, we had laws on the books at the turn of the previous century limiting sales of cigarettes to those over 21. But this law is a federal law, which is the first of its kind to really require that people who purchase cigarettes or vaping products be 21 years of age. Some localities, some states have enacted that law, but this really levels the playing field across the country so that there's not this patchwork of different laws. How old do you have to be to purchase these products?
Last time we talked to you, we were talking about Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, a tobacco state, being in favor of this idea. We've seen some tobacco companies and organizations in favor of this as well, apparently. Why were they backing it?
Well, it's a good question. Some may say that it's an amazing bipartisan effort to do the right thing. Healthier people, free from nicotine addiction and smoking-related diseases. But I think most people think that the tobacco industry has a long record, and Mitch McConnell and others who lobby on behalf of the tobacco industry, think that there's, you know, they wouldn't vote against their best interest. And so some people think that the impact will be actually quite small on cigarette sales and sales of vaping products, especially if it's not enforced. And so that's a question. What will the states do? The federal government's not going to enforce this age restriction. It will be up to states and localities. So what's going to happen with enforcement? And the second concern, and I think it's still a theoretical concern, is that Congress and local legislators and communities will say, well, we've done enough. We've raised it to 21. That should take care of it. And there are other really important things that could be done, and maybe the impetus or the inertia to do those things will be less.
Right. One thing that isn't here that some people were looking for was banning flavored vaping products, or at least some of them that might appeal more to kids. What do you make of that part of the story?
Well, this is not a ban on flavored products,
right.
And there's good evidence that the flavoring in vaping products is clearly intended to target to kids. Adults who are attempting to use vaping products or nicotine replacement therapy never sought out bubblegum flavored and cherry flavored nicotine replacement products. So it's clearly targeted towards kids. So that this law does not address that. It doesn't prohibit communities from doing that, and that was a concern when we spoke last spring, that perhaps this law would have preempting local communities and states from enacting flavor bans, and that's not contained in the law. So I think it still leaves that door open. Most people are saying this is a move in the right direction. There, in 2015, there was a National Academy of Sciences very detailed review. The research is pretty thin on whether raising the age to 21 will affect smoking, but the consensus is that it will decrease youth initiation and then down the road improve the public's health. So it's a good thing for public health. You just have to keep your eyes open and not simply rest on your laurels and keep looking at doing things that will reduce the harms from cigarette smoking.
Well, you mentioned enforcement here as being a big part of the issue. Do we know what works when it comes to enforcing a ban on selling cigarettes to minors, whether our breaking point is 18 or it's 21?
Well, we do. There's a lot of research on enforcement of sales. Those mostly were up to age 18 and mostly related to cigarette sales. Back in the 1990s, we began through an amendment to the Maternal and Child Block Grant called the SINAR Amendment. And in order for states to get their grants from the federal government for maternal and child health, you had to do inspections for bans. And those, so people who were selling knew that if they sold to kids, that they could be, that there might be a sting operation and that they could be penalized. So we know enforcement works. It's tough to do. It's easier just to simply have the law on the books and assume that it'll take care of itself. So, and it's not clear that there are no funding dollars in this bill to provide enforcement. So it'll really be up to communities and states to pick up from this federal law.
Sometimes people make the case that, hey, passing a law, even if it's not heavily enforced, sends a message, a public health message, a moral message to the community. Does just passing a law like this in and of itself say something to the teens of the and 18 to 20-year-olds of the country?
I think it does. I think it encourages conversations between parents and kids about the harms of not just cigarette smoking, but of vaping and getting addicted to nicotine. It also sets a standard so that communities may want to go further and do things that go beyond simply restricting the sales to those 21 years of age and older. So I think it's a good step in the right direction.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, we're looking at a change in the minimum age for smoking and e-cigarette purchases nationwide. This is a federal change. It passed in Congress as part of a really big spending bill. Dr. Remington, let's take a look at smoking trends and e-cigarette trends among teens in this country. What do we know about what's been happening over the years?
Well, this is a fascinating, what we call a natural experiment. We were not ready for e-cigarettes as a sort of public health research community. In Europe, a nicotine product called snus came out about 10 or 15 years ago. And the research showed that as people began using the smokeless product, which delivers nicotine in a relatively safe way, in some ways similar to vaping, smoking rates, smoking rates plummeted. And the consensus was that this may have actually been good for public health, that with less smoking, you see less lung cancer and heart disease and bronchitis, emphysema. People's health improved, even though some of these kids become addicted. That may be happening in the U.S. with vaping. We just don't know if the as kids get more exposure to nicotine products like vaping products, maybe they're going to be less likely to smoke. The early evidence is that cigarette smoking rates are at the lowest ever recorded, and the thoughts by some researchers are that this may be a result of kids becoming addicted to nicotine, but not through cigarettes, through vaping products. So I think the jury is definitely still out on this. Clearly what we'd like is kids not to use any nicotine devices, but it could be that with increases in vaping that we'll see fewer cigarette smokers and maybe better health outcomes down the road.
But pre-smokeless, pre-e-cigarette products, so wasn't smoking going down among teens already?
Yeah, the smoking rates have been declining since the early 2000s, and so this has been that's why there's debate. Mm-hmm. Just because there's a trend doesn't mean it necessarily will continue, and that trend has accelerated beyond what people had predicted. So we had sort of watched cigarette smoking rates come down in kids, and they began to level off, and they've just continued down to remarkably low levels. And there's pretty good evidence that there's a substitution that kids now. You could just talk to a young person who is vaping and ask them what they think about vaping versus cigarette smoking, and they tell me smoking is really bad for you. The word on the street is that vaping is not as bad, and it clearly doesn't lead to the cancers and heart disease and respiratory diseases that smoking does. It's not good for you. It would be better if kids didn't vape, but from a harm reduction strategy in a population, it may be that the overall impact is fewer people dying from cigarette smoking related illnesses down the road.
I want to get your thought on yet another part of this story. These what appear to be mostly linked to bootleg e-cigarette products, many with THC. We see a lot of people with very acute lung problems, some deaths, dozens of deaths now around the country. What kind of approach can we take there to these already illegal products?
Well, that's a great question. One of the laws on the books in San Francisco actually bans e-cigarettes entirely, but they only ban unregulated e-cigarettes. And the move there, or the interest there, is to get the FDA to regulate these products. And this is an example of really an unregulated product. It is the Wild West of sort of teen substance abuse, and you don't know what you're getting. And so by having the lack of regulation and really the sort of the surprise dramatic increase in these products, we've been caught off guard. And I think people who are looking to make money can get into this business, put whatever product they want in, and young adults and kids don't know what they're getting. And that clearly needs to be addressed through better regulation, through enforcement. I think we'll see those laws coming, and particularly given the incredible harm that's been caused by the products that have been put into the vaping products.
Patrick, 30 seconds or so left. Now we have this increase in the minimum smoking age. What are you watching for next?
Well, we're clearly watching to make sure that this isn't one step forward, two steps back, that it is a step forward, that it's a bipartisan effort that will lead to lower rates of cigarette smoking and use of vaping products. But we don't want to stop there. We want to go on to laws and regulations that really continue to see progress in reducing addiction, reducing the harms from cigarette smoking.
Patrick, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. Happy holidays.
And to you, too. We've been talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, professor emeritus at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joins today for a look at Congress raising the age for buying tobacco and e-cigarettes to 21. That passed as part of a big spending bill. President Trump signed the whole package into law on Friday. You can share your thoughts on that idea. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. If you're into bird watching or you know someone who is, you might have heard of the concept of the big day. That's where somebody spots as many different bird species as they possibly can in just one 24-hour span. We've talked about that a little bit here on the show before. According to the Audubon Society, the biggest big day of them all was set by a team in Ecuador, which managed to spot 431 different species. That team of experienced birders planned their day, worked their way across the country, and saw birds in different ecosystems to set that record. So 431 is pretty good, but a new article says there's an easy way to beat that. Just travel around the entire world in one day in a flying sleigh. In a new article, an Audubon writer tries to calculate how many bird species Santa could spot in one night of high-speed chimney deliveries. He gets a slow start at the North Pole, not a great place for birds in the winter. A North Pole birder put that to the test a few Decembers back and saw just a common raven. So that's one bird for Santa's count. But then he picks up steam along the way. In addition to the chimney swifts he'd see on his way in and out of houses, Santa could spot tons of birds, especially once he made it into the tropics. There's a lot of math and guesswork involved, but the number Audubon arrives at for Santa's big day, 661 bird species. See if you can top that. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.